welcome to the season 3 wrap for Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. Today, you'll hear an excerpt of my conversation with Aeron. We will talk about our expectations for House of the Dragon. I'm going to be having a little argument with Carl Nellis. It's not much of an argument. He wins pretty handily. And I concede pretty quickly about genre in Game of Thrones. And he calls me out for some of the derisive things that I've said about fantasy literature at large. And he's totally right. He also has some really great suggestions for summer reading of other fantasy series. Steve and I field listener questions. And then in my bird's eye view section, I answer definitively once and for all the question on everyone's mind. Is it possible to be both a battlefield badass and a genius strategist in Martin's world? The answer, of course, is no. But maybe. So, anyway, without further ado, here is Boseman Aeron.
Actually, you know, I had my Game of Thrones heart kind of broken. I had a very public break up with the Double D's and all that in season 8. But I gotta say, as I'm, you know, starting to research and getting into some of the stuff about the Fire and Blood, I'm feeling the excitement grow. And I'm also like, I'm really hoping for House of the Dragon to be really good. And, you know, from the casting stuff and some of the leaks I've seen, like it looks like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of intrigue. The only thing I talked about this with Jim on the preview thing that we did in between your last two seasons. The thing I'm a little bit worried is Game of Thrones sucked in a lot of people with the West Wing House of Cards style politics. And they really, the magic, like years, you know, you start the thing with like a slap in the face with ice zombies. But that this just goes deep background until the finale of season 1. And then the magic stuff keeps getting pushed back to the background for the first 2 or 3 seasons. And then, of course, it comes, you know, roaring back with the dragons and the White Walkers and all that kind of stuff. This series is not going to be like that. This series is going to be dragons at their most powerful.
Yeah.
You're going to have the pyromancers at full power. You're going to have warlock. You're going to, like, they've already got some kind of witch character in the retinue of the royal family. I do wonder if it's going to be a little bit too Lord of the Ringsy, but I don't know. Like, you know, Game of Thrones had 100 million fans watching it day one at its peak. And these people are, even if they were like, I don't like that sword and sandals and dragon shit, they got into the swords and sandals and dragon shit. So it seems plausible for me that, like, even factoring in people maybe being disenchanted by season 8, half of that audience is going to come back just out of curiosity.
I think
and
so.
If it's a good first season, watch out. They could be back on top just like that.
Let me ask you this question. So if you think of all the Star Wars films in the franchise, how many of those do you actually really enjoy that don't feature Han Solo?
Oh, that don't feature Han Solo. Ooh, that's a damn good question. Because I'm not a big prequels fan. I like Rogue One.
Oh, you like Rogue One. Okay.
I did like Rogue One. Jin doesn't, but I really liked Rogue One. I thought Rogue One was really good. Not many. Not many.
See, that's my concern. My concern is that if you take Tyrion Lannister out of the story, does the story still have enough to bring that magic to life? Because I feel like a lot of what made Star Wars work is you've got that Han Solo character to kind of balance out the, you know, space fantasy stuff. Tyrion kind of fills that void, and if you don't bring in a Dinklage type, I'm gonna be worried.
Well, we do have Corlys Velaryon, the sea snake, who is literally Han Solo on a wooden sailing ship.
Okay, that's a
good
point.
He's got the fastest hunk of junk in the kingdoms, and he like it. So I kind of got high hopes for some of these other colorful characters. We also. We did love, when we were reading Fire and Blood, we did love us some Cregan Stark.
That's true.
We got the Hour of the Wolf to look forward to. There's some good stuff. Mushroom. I was campaigning really hard for Mushroom the dwarf to make an appearance.
So Mushroom, I feel like Mushroom is
He's Bizarro Tyrion.
He kind of is Bizarro Tyrion, which is kind of interesting in and of itself. But
Yeah. And it'd be a lot of fun. Like I this is not going to happen. This is just pure fan bullshit. But like, I do have this idea of like, oh, what if they got Peter Dinklage to like the framing device is mushroom, old and satisfied with his days in some kind of alehouse in Westeros. Decades after this has all taken place, like, you know, no one recognizes him. He's just kind of and it's Peter Dinklage, you know, aged up, and he's just drunkenly starting to recount these tales. And that's like, it's kind of like a How I Met Your Mother, but it's like in the first episode and the last episode. I think that would be really cool that these are just mushroom in some kind of tavern, telling tales to anybody who will flip him a silver stag.
Well, one thing's for sure, I will be watching. I will absolutely be watching House of the Dragon.
Hell yeah.
I'm going to, you know, it's got the benefit of the doubt for sure.
Yep. And we will all know by next year whether they've rekindled the magic, whether the fires of the dragons are burning again, or whether, you know, we got a fall spring situation on our hands.
All right, man. Always great to connect. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Talk to you later.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Hey, Carl, I would like to talk about some larger genre issues, because I think you and I may have some good, you know, some good friction.
Yes.
Here. I actually just want to have the conversation. I don't have a strong opinion to defend, but I think that you might have some interesting ideas about what kind of genre we're dealing with.
Well, I do, because, you know, I mean, I love Game of Thrones. I also love the show that you've been making and the conversations that you've had with other guests so far, have been so rich and really fun. Of course, one of the things that makes listening in on good conversations fun is finding points where you disagree. Even where you disagree, oh, passionately. You know, earlier in this podcast, you said that, you were talking about genre at that point, fantasy and science fiction, and you said, when people say they like fantasy and science fiction, your guess was that most people like science fiction and maybe there's one or two works of fantasy that they actually like. Yeah. And this is what set me off, where you said, and that's really because most fantasy is unreadable.
Yeah, I do think that. I feel bad saying it because some of my favorite works of literature are fantasy, but there's some really bad stuff out there, Carl.
That's true. And you first said that in a conversation with Chad. Yeah, and right. I really liked that Chad pushed back a little bit, and he said, I think that's probably pretty true for science fiction, too, that, you know, there's a small amount of really good stuff, and then there's kind of a mass of
and
okay
I think Chad
stuff.
Might have also said something like, hey, that's true for most of all literature.
Yes.
I'm really picky, and most of the stuff is, you know, regardless of genre, it's pretty bad.
Exactly. So I was like, yes, Chad. and it wasn't quite a full rejoinder to what you said, but yeah, I kind of heard a black mark against a genre, but in a way that was bringing in criticism that's basically true of writing. You know, I mean, I think about scholarship in many fields and think there's a lot of good stuff and there's a lot of mediocre stuff. You know, I think about most published work, you know, across genre, like Chad said. You know, so of course I started thinking about the other fantasy that I really, really love, that I find just as rich as Tolkien or Martin. The first thing that comes to mind is Susanna Clarke's Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is amazing. And similarly to Martin, and you know, my personal opinion is that it surpasses Martin in this way, that it is so dense with literary allusions and engagements with history. You know, and one of the things that's really fun about Martin is that you can jump to, you know, to medieval history, to the Wars of the Roses, to, you know, all those things that you want to bring in as enriching context. The same kind of thing you can do with Susanna Clarke's book. I'm reading a book now by Sophia Samatar called A Stranger in Alondria that similarly, just the richness of the world building is incredible. And the voice of the narrator, so stylish, so fascinating, so such a pleasure to read. You know,
well, I absolutely haven't tried that at all. So I'll give that a try for sure.
If you know,
I do feel that way. I mean, here we have the problem, I think, with ratio versus anecdotal evidence.
Yes, yes, yes.
Right? Because, you know, we have, like, for instance, like, I love Mary Doria Russell's The Sparrow.
Right. Oh, yeah, me too.
Easily classified as a science fiction. I think it's an amazing book, but if I start to think, you know, so I can kind of point to that as just really wonderful science fiction, but what I'm not thinking of, that I can't even think of the names of, but I know that it's true. I can't remember the name of the 10 titles that I picked up and started reading and couldn't get through the first chapter because it was just unreadable. And then, of course, you find that one piece and that's the one that sticks in your memory. I don't know. So I guess here's my question. Like, do you feel like the ratio for quality fantasy is as high as the ratio for good science fiction, if against the backdrop of the other works in the genre?
Yeah, I do. And some of that is because of how many science fiction series novels I've tried to read and quit after the first chapter.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point.
And not to say that I'm some kind of high-minded reader. No, like I spent middle school and high school just reading and rereading over and over, you know, Star Wars novels.
Right.
Just writing in my favorite genre. And, you know, Star Wars is one of those ideas that always gets argued about at the crossroads of science fiction and fantasy, right? You know, what's going on with the Force and these knights and these swords?
Yeah, I'm always arguing that Star Wars really is fantasy.
Yes, yes. So,
but those books suck. So, I mean,
but I love them. You know, I can love
them
so deeply.
You're just not going to win me over with those books at all. But here's the other thing with sci-fi. I think until very recently, sci-fi on film was sort of the standard sci-fi on film was a B movie.
Yes.
You know, the plot, dialogue, the acting, we all kind of forgave. I mean, I absolutely love all of the Star Trek franchise, but I have to acknowledge that most of the acting is just not great. You know, it's just, it's high concept, fantastic, not very well delivered. I think it's just been in the last couple decades that we've actually seen super high quality storytelling when it comes to the genres that we used to kind of assign to sort of a B movie kind of storytelling technique.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the writers that I studied when I was looking at medievalism in literature is Jack Vance. And he's an author who was writing science fiction and fantasy. And one of the things that I loved was looking at his letters with editors. You know, I was an editor for a while. And he was constantly submitting work to John Campbell, who was editing Analog at the time, one of the major science fiction magazines. And Campbell was a giant in science fiction, in shaping what is science fiction. You know, we're talking mid-century, you know, mid-1900s. Mm-hmm. And Campbell was constantly turning him down because he was saying, this isn't science fiction. Vance was saying,
It's too good?
Well, Vance was saying,
it's not pulpy enough?
Well,
is that what
it wasn't
saying?
Technological. It wasn't a physics problem or a mechanics problem. And Vance was saying, my characters fly to an alien world. They meet this alien, and it's about biology, and the science that's involved here is this alien biology and these eggs, and Campbell was having none of it. He was like, soft science. You know, he was like writing off biology as a science and saying
he wanted something that like dealt with some machine.
Yes. Yes.
Some machine that a human created that changes everything for the human.
Yeah, so border trouble, right, between what's science fiction and what's fantasy, mm-hmm. or, you know, what's good enough to be called science fiction, or, you know, it was also interesting listening to one of your later conversations with Dr. Webster, where he was talking about science fiction as the fiction of social dilemmas, and he was also talking, what I heard at least, was science fiction good, fantasy, questionable. And I almost hear this kind of...
I did get that sense with him. Now, I think his larger point was he thought that Martin basically traffics in science fiction and horror, and that this book really is a science fiction, or a Game of Thrones is really a science fiction that's kind of disguised as a fantasy. And I think, I don't feel strongly about that, but I do think that there's some merit to viewing this book as a hybrid.
Yeah, same. I mean, I've read science fiction disguised as fantasy, like Anne McCaffrey's Dragon Riders of Pern, you know, which starts out as like, right. Dragon Riders medieval, and then over time you realize, oh, this is, you know, people who crash landed in a spaceship on an alien world with these teleporting lizards, you know. But what I heard in that was a little, you know, with someone who likes Game of Thrones, but is a little bit ashamed that they like fantasy.
Mm.
And so they have to figure out a way to decide that it's actually something that's respectable to like, science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think about other recent fantasy that's been published, like N.K. Jemisin's.
And I think that there may be a similar kind of polemical move when I call Star Wars fantasy.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just a preference thing. I like the elements of fantasy can be a lot more loosey-goosey than the elements of the kinds of sci-fi I like. But even in saying that, I kind of know that most sci-fi plays fast and loose with the rules.
Yes.
And I tend to forgive it in those ways.
Yeah. I mean, if what you want is a very grimdark fantasy of apocalypse that deals with oppressive social regimes, including, like, you know, sexual predation and people trying to find their way out of a rigid and violent hierarchy, read N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth, you know, the fifth season, the first novel. Fantastic. Recent book, recent series, won all kinds of awards. Fantasy, but it engages some of the things that, you know, might be considered social dilemmas or, you know, our fear now of apocalypse. It's, you know, so similarly kind of horror, sci-fi, fantasy, you know, what do you want to call it? It's fantasy. It's very obviously fantasy, but it doesn't shy away from engaging those deep questions and social dilemmas that make fiction powerful.
So I hear your a strong defense of fantasy as a genre. I think you're right that this interview series has, without warrant, maligned the genre. And I offer a heartfelt apology to all who are offended by my unjustified polemic against fantasy literature.
Well, I want to offer you an olive branch and say I know that one of the things you love, because you've written two books about it, coming out of Game of Thrones, is religious systems, you know, the difference between personal devotion and tradition and those kinds of things that, you know, that your two Gods of Thrones books are about. There's a series by Lois McMaster Bujold that starts with The Curse of Chalion that has such a fascinating theology to it. The religious systems.
Okay, tell me that one again, because I'm going to have to look that up.
Yeah, the series is even called The World of the Five Gods.
Okay.
The first book is called The Curse of Chalion.
Okay. I think I might have started that at one point.
And you found it unreadable.
No, I wouldn't say unreadable. I just don't have a strong memory of it. It could have been like one of those times where like I started something and then I had a writing project that kind of sidetracked me.
Yeah.
I think I did try to start that first book at one point. But let me ask you a question. Do you think that Game of Thrones has sci-fi elements? Do you think it's a hybrid between sci-fi and fantasy? Do you think it's disguised as fantasy? Or is your definition of fantasy broad enough to include all of the sort of elements that we would normally associate with sci-fi in Game of Thrones?
Yeah, I mean, I think for folks who really love fantasy, it's easy to make distinctions between something that's grimdark, something that's high fantasy, something that's sword and sorcery, something that's, you know, there are all kinds of ways of talking about literature, you know, that you can cut it and you can cross cut it. You know, you can talk about environmental fiction, you know, here where we have this winter that's coming and the things that Martin's doing with seasons and fear of apocalypse, you know, but environmental fiction can cut across things that would be known as fantasy or science fiction or, you know, literary fiction, contemporary.
Yeah, I want to talk more about environmental fiction, because I think that what gets underplayed here, especially in this first book, is all of the work that Martin has done to really call out the what is the most weird about this world, and that is the magical seasons.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And there's a little bit, you know, there is some fantasy elements of this, you know, like you know, for instance, you know, the always winter and never Christmas theme and in Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia.
Yeah.
But of course that's also a metaphor for exile and, you know, sort of the symbolism of good weather is usually symbolic for life, right? If you can trust the weather, you know, it's going to be life ahead. And if the weather does not allow it, then there's death because crops or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that polarity between good weather equals life, bad weather equals death. That to me is sort of the gurgling undercurrent of this book. It's never really explained, but Martin has been pretty adamant that the only explanation you're ever going to get for why this is the case is that the seasons are magic in this world. So here we have this sort of key sci-fi element, but when pressed on it, Martin has always kind of gone to a fantasy explanation.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to hear you talk more about sort of the environmental elements here.
Well, I'm really interested in where an author brings magic into their world. You know, what does the magic do? What does it almost cover for? You know, what is it that they want to have in their story so much that they put it in? There isn't a mechanism that they can explain behind it, so they say, well, that's the magic. So honestly, what I see in that is a really powerful idea where Martin wants to say, what would human life be like if these seasons were like this, if winter was this devastating, if summer was this long? And this push to explain, you know, show me, you know, strip away the outer casing and show me the engine underneath. And he's saying, this is how the world works. This is the mystery. Accept the mystery. Because what we want to see is the consequences of that. That is a kind of move that is often made in fantasy. You know, this is what I want. This is a kind of hypothetical that I want to play out fictionally. And it's not about, you know, bringing my empiricism to it and stripping off the veil and getting at the mechanics. And maybe this is what you say, part of what you love about science fiction is being satisfied by the mechanics of a world.
There's this delicate thing that an author needs to do whereby I'm happy to suspend disbelief, but there's like a threshold. And if you cross the threshold, then I kind of feel like, it's too much. And which is really kind of remarkable considering how much magic is actually in this world that Martin's creating.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just all over the place, but it's in this first novel, it's really subtle. At least it's presented that way early on anyway.
Right, right.
I do feel like, okay, so now that we're talking about sort of the larger themes of ice and fire, I mean, my sense is that, you know, the others are really kind of an avatar for winter. That much seems very clear to me. And the dragons, you know, dragons coming into the world really bring a balance to that because, you know, the even though they're monsters, they're really avatars for the heat. And so in order for the world to kind of work the way that it ought to work, you almost need these sort of battles between summer and winter. I don't know. What do you think? Am I making too much of the avatar thing, do you think?
No. I mean, what I like is that we have these embodiments of, right, those powers, those elemental forces, and you're going to have the periods of their dominance, and summer and winter, you know, some of them rising and some of them falling, and that, you know, calling on something like Norse mythology and the Ginnungagap and mythologies where ice and fire are key, you know, and life comes out of fire melting the ice and you know, melting the ice away from a living thing that is able to emerge because of the fire. You know, it's kind of existentialist in that meaning and that life is born out of this struggle. And there's plenty of struggle in Martin, you know, and often what he's writing with these characters.
Yeah, in that way, dragons really do function. Like, if this little thesis we're developing works, the dragons really do function the way that dragons functioned in Chinese mythology, where the dragon lives under the river and then brings the rain when it flies to heaven or flies to the clouds or whatever, so that the dragons will actually bring rain, and you need rain. You know, the farmers need rain for the crops. But really you need a sort of this yin-yang balance between the tiger energy and the dragon energy. And I think that even though Martin doesn't really draw a whole lot from Eastern mysticism, if this little thesis we're developing holds water, I think that the dragons kind of do function in the way that Chinese dragons do.
And I would even say that Martin's world is structured around a kind of dualism, like you're saying. I mean, you could say like a Manichaean dualism or you know, that violence of opposing forces is simply like the basic structure of the world or something like that.
Yeah, you've got monsters on this side and monsters on that side. They're not good or bad.
Yeah.
They're just monsters, and they don't care about humans, but it's their job to battle their opposite. And unfortunately, being a human in between two monsters, it can be really perilous.
Right, and the only way to win a future is to fight. You know, the only way to preserve life is to struggle, kind of thing, in the midst of the universal forces that struggle and fight and kill and die and are reborn. Human beings caught amidst those forces also have to struggle and fight and kill and die and be reborn.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I wouldn't like crank it up. I've tried that before and it hasn't gone very well.
Because it's on, I could put it back to auto.
I don't think I'm really going to know until I actually hear the file.
Okay.
So I don't know if I'm going to be able to tell just by this. So I say let's just go for
what's
it.
What's your problem?
What's my problem?
Let's start that. Let's start the Q&A right now. What's your problem?
I mean, I guess it probably relates to growing up in a family with six kids, being an introvert, and never finding a place to kind of be alone.
Right.
I guess yeah. Everything probably stems from that. It could be, there's a lot of religious baggage, I would imagine.
Sure, and being the only male child without a twin probably is a problem.
And also the third child.
Third born, least wanted, probably.
The third child is always a little weird, I think. It's
well,
always
you could have
a
been
little
the
bit
end.
Like, we had a unit. We had a good, solid unit here. We've already proven we can do this twice. A third? Do you really need a third?
Well, see, I look at it like, I mean, you have the first, you have the rough draft, right?
Yeah.
You're like, okay, we're going to do everything we can to protect it because this is like the only mm-hmm. work I've done. And then you have the second draft and it's like, okay, this one's got like a bunch of notes on it. And you're like, okay, the third one, I'm turning this one in. And then it was you and they're like, okay, this one we're turning in. We've taken our lumps as parents. And then they just started just pumping out more babies, right? Just
well, at that point, it was like, okay, we're not going for quality anymore, just quantity. That's what we're doing.
Yeah,
now.
We're just gonna throw a bunch of these at the wall.
Three more of these things, and hope one of them works out.
Yeah, and then they had a Groupon for the last two, so that worked out.
Interestingly enough, none of us really worked out.
No, that's a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very rare that you'll have six kids and they all turn out to be, you know, not great.
Just right, and the beauty of it is that as the expectations lower, the disappointment somehow gets higher.
See, I think that's at some incredible point you got to think there is something genetic here because it could be that it's just these two people weren't meant to produce human beings.
Right. Or not as many, right? Because then they like now their attention is so divided. And it was like, maybe if we just put all our eggs in one basket, you know. No, I mean, I get it. Like, I mean, like as a parent, you know, it's like you have all these different, like your expectations are so different, right? Like, and that's what I realized. If you lower your expectations, the chance of being disappointed are less. Like, it used to be like, oh, my son will be, you know, like maybe he could be president someday. And then at the end, you're just like, as long as he outlives me, I feel like I did okay.
President, I never thought president would be a great thing for a child. Like, I it's always a weird thing to wish on a child.
But it guarantees they move out.
That's true, because they get their own yeah. residence.
Exactly.
At least for 4 years.
That's what I'm campaigning for, heavy.
All right, so I think the mic needs to come in a little closer to the mouth.
Like if you can see what I'm doing, I mean, I'm almost deep-throating
it.
I'm almost
that's
deep-throating this thing.
You got to deep-throat it. You have to.
Yeah, dude, I am like, yeah.
That's
it. I'm cross-eyed by looking at this thing.
You're in. You're right there. You're in. You can't ever move now.
All right. So here we go.
Okay. Let's count it down.
Okay.
5.
4.
3.
2.
1. It's counting down again without the sarcasm this time.
I did pretty good.
Without the attitude, please.
You know what? I'm going to get farther away from the mic.
All right, Steve. I got questions for you. I got questions for me. I'm going to start with a question for you.
Okay.
This question is from Anthony in Dayton, Ohio.
Huh.
Yeah. I don't do last names. So, Steve, season 3 was bear heavy. How do you feel about bears?
I got mixed feelings on bears. I'm on record.
You are on record. In yeah. fact, you were interviewed just recently in our local newspaper.
Actually, KTVU Channel 2 News. I was on the 10 o'clock news. As I was pulling into my shared driveway, an easement, if you will, I saw this guy tromping through my neighbor's yard with a very large camera and a very large tripod.
So you have no idea who he was. He said he was from the news.
Well, I was all ready to give him attitude. I stepped out of my car because he was making his way towards my house, and I was going to do the can I help you with something, friend? You know, like the when you say friend, oh man, that cuts yeah. deep.
Sure.
So I was all ready. And then he says, have you heard about the bear? Immediately let my guard down. Like immediately all my attitude, which shows that I was probably bluffing even to myself. I probably wasn't
going
to do that.
So backstory for the listeners here. I guess there was a bear sighting near your house.
There's numerous bear sightings via the Nextdoor app. People have been showing that their little night cameras have shown the bear nearby. I even talked to a person that worked at the post office annex yesterday, and she's like, oh yeah, that bear's been around for a long time, just not in that area. I'm like, wait, what? Yeah.
So the bear just got lost.
Well, the bear's
and this apparently is newsworthy in Sebastopol, California.
Right, because we don't get bears, apparently. But to some people, they're like, yeah, no, the bear's there, you just gotta look for it. This time, you don't have to look for it, the bear shows up. This is what happens when you have like these social media apps, right, these Nextdoor apps. I mean, that bear has probably been, now that we have so many cameras, we have cameras on everything, cameras on our mailboxes, our doorbells, bears don't get to live in anonymity anymore at all. So it's not the bears, I don't think, that are different. It's us.
So how do you feel about these bears?
I like bears. I said this on the news, and I'll reiterate it because it doesn't make it less true now that we're doing the same interview. I would really like the idea. One part of me is like, I like the idea of seeing a bear. And then there's another part of me that's like, I don't know if I ever need to see a bear. And it's a wrestling match internally. Because it is. It's tough. Because it's like, if I saw it, I'd be like, oh, like my wife was very clear. Like, if you saw a bear, like this became a thing. Like, I was like, oh, I would love to see a bear. And she's like, if you saw a bear right now, you couldn't handle it. I'm like, come on. I could handle a bear. She's like, if there was a bear in our backyard, you would freak out. And I'm like, whoa. And then I got like really like irritated because I'm like, no, I don't think so.
That's what Steve sounds like when he's really irritated with
yeah.
Heather.
No. I don't think so. Well, I mean, and if there's anybody that knows me probably the best, I would assume it's my wife. And I just felt really like, how dare you? Right. And I don't know. I mean, honestly, if I saw a bear, I would do one of two things. I made this noise. I'm going to share with you and the listening audience a noise that I didn't know I had the capability of making. And when I was on a Mexico trip, we were staying at this very bizarre little compound type situation. And they had a couple of really large dogs that kind of protected the property.
Is this like a drug situation?
No.
You're describing the cartel is what you're saying.
Yeah. Look, man, we have to go into the details. Look, yada, yada, yada. I was in this compound. There's a bunch of guard dogs.
All right.
And so I went in the middle of the night to urinate outside. And one of the dogs did not know that I was, compound friendly and came up behind me and growled the most terrifying guttural growl. And I'm standing there urinating. And I did something. I went, oh. I made that noise out loud. I didn't mean to. It just sort of fell out of me.
You learn interesting things about yourself in yeah. such situations.
Yeah, there's those that fight. There are those that go with flight, and there are those that are just trying to work on a harmony by themselves. Yeah, it was as if I was trying to blow into a kazoo without the kazoo. Like, that's the noise we make without the kazoo.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating thing about the California black bear, I think it comes in 6 different colors.
Not just black.
No. No, it's brown, you get white, you get blonde, you can get cinnamon.
You get a white black bear.
Yeah. Yeah, so apparently when the settlers named it, they saw a black bear and says, that's a black bear forever.
Mm-hmm.
All the bears are black bears. Like, I mean, that's the pressure I think that we put on ourselves. Imagine, like, you just feeling like, oh, well, we got to name this thing now because we discover it.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the one dumb settler who saw it first and is like, black bear. And you're like, oh, come on, man. I'm going to name it anything. Could have been any kind of bear. Like, it was over there by the lake. It could be lake bear or it could be like Sweetwater bear. But like, no, you called it black bear. I'm like, oh, look, there's a brown one of those. Yep, also black bear. Okay, come on, stop it. There's white black bears, there's cinnamon black. Oh, well.
All righty. This is a question from our old friend Baton Rouge Billy. He's back, Steve.
That's right.
This is a question for me.
Red Stick Bill.
Red Stick Bill. Welcome back, Red Stick. This is a question for me. Are you enjoying this rewatch more now that Steve is involved? Or are you enjoying it less because it's more work, because of the podcast? How are you finding the differences this time around? Well, Bill, I'm enjoying it a lot more. I mean, I enjoyed it. It's certainly different. You enjoy something the first time around, and if you're willing to watch it again, you probably enjoyed it a lot the first time around. If you're willing to watch it multiple times, you probably really like it anyway. I think getting Steve involved has definitely enhanced my appreciation of the show because Steve likes it too. And so I'm kind of watching it vicariously through Steve's eyes. And I get there's a little bit of like, I don't know, sort of evangelistic zeal. Like, I know Steve wouldn't necessarily like a fantasy epic, but because I coaxed him in and I got him to watch it and he likes it, I kind of feel like, yeah, I won one for the team. I won a convert for our side.
Wow.
So, yeah, these are all the ways that I'm enjoying.
So this is sort of like when James Dobson and Ted Bundy meet in heaven.
Are you assuming that that's the first time they've ever met?
Well, I know that they met, you know, because they met when Bundy was in prison, but like the idea
because
that
they
like,
were
James,
they were
but James Dobson
they were involved together in all of those killings.
Because he believed, because, you know, Dobson supposedly converted Ted Bundy.
Focus.
To,
he doesn't just want to focus on the family. He wants to focus on your family and kill them.
That's right. Yeah. Laser focus on the family.
So, yeah. Okay.
So you're James Dobson and I'm Ted Bundy in this situation.
Is that how it's okay?
Yeah.
Very interesting.
That's the faith our families have latched onto. Just understand that. Just understand that for eternity.
Steve, this is a question from Gareth. should we just end it there? Because that seems like a great place to end it.
There's not a lot of podcasts. They're discussing the Dobson-Bundy relationship.
This is from Gareth in Aberdeen. This is a long question, Steve.
Okay.
I'm gonna do my best to not fumble this. All right. So, Steve, in this season, we learned that you have the uncanny ability to regrow nipples.
Mm-hmm.
In essence, you're an X-Man. Granted, your superpower is somewhat benign. I have a proposal.
So far, I haven't seen the end goal.
I have a proposal for you to consider. My older brother is a research scientist at a university here in Scotland. His success has always annoyed me, but maybe you can help. I propose that you allow me to study you here in my garage. I will publish my findings and taunt my older brother, and you can parlay this notoriety to start a school for gifted children. What do you think?
First off, I love any mission that is fueled by spite is a mission I'm automatically intrigued by.
Sure.
Which is essentially how Americans got to the moon, right?
It really is how we got to the moon. And it is also the origin story of many different supervillains.
Right. But I mean, all right. So here's the deal, Gareth, and I hope you're listening. I've never been to Scotland. If you're willing to cover travel and boarding, I'll let you do whatever you want to me in your garage.
I'm sure he's just going to have you sleep in the garage.
I don't think if I'm going to be at his garage, I'm going to allow myself to sleep at any moment during this trip.
He just wants to poke at your nipples, man. I think you're missing the point.
That's the gateway.
I think he's got other things in mind.
Well, I think the obvious question is, does the regeneration stop at the nipples, right? So yeah. So that's going to be the question, and I don't know where we go from there.
I mean, if you think about it, I like the way he's framed this. He calls it your uncanny ability to regrow nipples. I think, yes, as far as a superpower goes, it may be the most worthless superpower ever.
Again, we don't know.
Because nipples on men are really not useful in the first place. So unlimited uselessness.
Well, I mean, it seems like clearly maybe there's more to the physiology than we understand, right? I mean, and I think what we've learned from this is that Wolverine is clearly not circumcised.
He can't be.
Well, I mean, he could be for a minute.
He could be accidentally every time he tries to pee.
That's right.
So, all right. So, good. We've got a sort of the beginnings of an interesting relationship with Gareth.
Mm-hmm. If the next Q&A takes place from Scotland, you'll know Gareth's brother's about to be brought down a notch.
For Steve, loving the podcast. If you were to do a non-Game of Thrones podcast, what would it be about? Have you ever discussed it? We actually have discussed this from time to time. You've had a number of good ideas, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, Anthony and I, we have a lot of shared experience. And, you know, whether it's through film or you know, television shows, or just, you know, whether it's been like the aforementioned religious commonality in terms of our upbringings, just living in West County of California, you know, there's lots to discuss there. I don't know if we've settled on anything, or I know we've kicked
some
things off.
No, we haven't. I mean, it sounds like we've had a few ideas. Because of our commonalities, I thought it'd be fun to do a Stranger Things podcast, mm-hmm. because that's kind of our era.
Right.
But my idea was that we wouldn't just cover the show. We'd cover the movies and pop culture phenomena that show up in the show.
Right, so kind of like a little bit of the rewatch to discuss, and then also the nuances that are sort of embedded into each, like little Easter eggs, right? Like exploring those. Some are a little bit more obvious than others.
That was one of my ideas. What was one of your ideas?
Well, I had an idea, and it may just be more of just me talking to the void. Where I wanted to have a podcast that just discussed every single aspect of the movie Lost Boys.
Just Lost Boys all the time.
Right. Like, so like, you know, an entire episode, like there's a point where when the grandpa opens up the refrigerator to tell Michael about what rows of the refrigerator, what shelves he can use. And like one of the ones that like you can't use, there was a peanut butter boppers in there. And like, so like for me, an entire episode, if at least one episode would be discussing peanut butter boppers, the Nature Valley hidden gem that, you know, we all want to come back, but for whatever reason.
Okay. Another idea that you had that I liked was related to 80s sitcom specials.
Oh, yeah. A very special podcast. Yeah, because it was very popular in the 80s and 90s, too, I guess, where they would have like a very special episode of something, right? Like, you know, whether it's Alex P. Keaton's uncle played by Tom Hanks, who turns out to be a drunk. You know, it starts off hilarious, but then it ends, you know, very serious.
For the younger listeners, there used to be this thing with sitcoms where like once every couple of years they would try to do a serious episode to kind of teach us about things like addiction or, you know, some kind mm-hmm. of, I don't know, like molestation or something.
Right. Wesley from Mr. Belvedere, his friend got AIDS during the summer.
Yeah, teach us a little bit about AIDS.
Yeah. In a humorous fashion.
Yeah, almost humorous fashion.
Sure. Mr. Belvedere, sneaky amount of special episodes.
Besides the AIDS episode.
Besides the AIDS episode where the older brother gets really drunk and he ends up like, there's concern he has a drinking problem. Mm-hmm. Wesley on the Boy Scout trip. The entire series where a weird British guy just lives with him. No, I'm here to fold your clothes and your unmentionables. And everyone's like, oh, okay. His name is Lynn. That seems fine.
You're suggesting that the entire premise of the show is a little odd?
A little bit, yeah. The idea that Bob Uecker needs a British butler. Yeah, a little odd.
Okay, this is from WD and her feline dragons.
Mm-hmm.
This is for me, but it's kind of for us both because it says for, well, anyway, it says, okay, here's a little technical question for you or Steve. Did Jamie tuck in the junk before going over to help Bran? I mean, if you're in the middle of things and you get surprised, ... Given the context, I think WD is talking about in the book before Jamie pushes Bran out the window.
Mm-hmm.
So he's having sex with his sister.
Right.
He sees Bran, who's about to fall, and then he, like, grabs onto Bran to save him from falling.
Uh-huh.
Then they have their little exchange, and then he says, the things I do for love, and he pushes Bran out the window.
Right.
WD and her feline dragons want to know, is Jamie the kind of person who would tuck in his junk before doing that? Because the book doesn't say.
Right.
Now, I did rewatch the
scene
in the show.
I have my thoughts, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts. But I have my
thoughts. Let me say my thing, and then I'll throw it over to you. I did rewatch that little scene in the show, and I think that you just see Jamie like wearing a tunic from behind, and I think that there's this slight move to tuck in the junk. It's almost imperceptible.
You're suggesting that in the moment where he gets discovered that he's having sex with his sister and is about to attempt to murder a child, there was a little bit of discretion on Jamie's part.
Yeah, I don't think he's decided to murder Brandy. I think in the book at least, he jumps up out of the act of coitus and like grabs Bran, who's about to fall. So I think his first inclination was to save a child who's in, you know, peril.
Right.
In that moment when he's feeling very helpful, I don't know what he does with his genitalia. That's all the information that I can offer, but I'm curious to hear what you think, Steve.
So I think the timeline goes coitus.
Yeah.
Sees Bran.
Yeah.
Uncoitus.
Yeah.
Tuck. Save. Says the things we do for love. And at the same time that he releases Bran, he untucks.
Oh, wow.
That's even worse.
That is even worse.
Yeah, so that's the evolution, right? It's the, oh, no. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a... I think that... And I think if you'd seen that, you're... You know how, you know, we talk about the journey that Jamie goes on. Is he good? Is he bad? Wrestling match. I think if they show that in its entirety, I think it's almost impossible to redeem that character later.
Oh, absolutely. Because when that's the worst thing.
When he pinballs Bran out.
God, no. God, no, 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 no. This is the worst thing you've ever said. This is the worst thing. I gotta delete that. That's X-rated. So bad. So bad on so many levels.
Yeah, but it's a visual.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, all right. I think we're done. I think our relationship just ended. I'm canceling you out of my life.
This podcast is my one-way ticket out of hosting the Oscars.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For my final bird's eye view for this season, I'd like to expand on a conversation that I had with a number of fellow fans by email. You remember that I asked both Tara and Aaron to name a character who is both a top flight fighter and a genius strategist. Tara suggested Danny, and Aaron suggested Ned. Both, I think, are wrong. Danny can't control her dragons at this point. And Ned... That's not a genius. He's got other qualities. He's not a genius. I'm not saying he's stupid. He's just not a genius. Danny probably will become one of the most feared battlefield badasses. And Ned was a very good battlefield commander, but I think we can move on from these suggestions. I'm looking for characters in the books, so book specific, based on what we know through the end of Dance. Perhaps I need to define my categories a little bit better. Here's what I think. Let's call the first category Battlefield Badasses. These are characters that you would least want to face in an opposing army. You're standing in a field, and you absolutely do not want to see one of these faces staring back at you from the other line. So this type I'm calling the Battlefield Badasses. The other category I'm calling Genius Strategists. These are characters that are big picture power brokers, negotiators, politicians, Game of Thrones movers and shakers. This means that they aren't just smart. No doubt Catelyn is super smart. But they're thinking several moves ahead, planning not this battle, but planning the larger war and thinking about the next war too. So my initial thought was that it's generally true in Martin's world that characters don't check both boxes. If you're a top 10 Battlefield badass, you're not a top 10 genius strategist, and vice versa. Once I have those categories defined, I think it might be helpful to look at some of these lists that the internet has come up with for who the best warriors are in Game of Thrones. A lot of the folks on the internet that do this do keep in mind the show versus not just the books, and we're specifically focused on the books. But I thought it was interesting to look at this particular website, Den of Geek, 15 best warriors in order. Arya, so Arya's number one. Number two, The Mountain, Jaime, Bronn, Brienne, Grey Worm, Jon Snow, Hound, Barristan the Bold, Syrio, Loras, The Blackfish, Corrin Halfhand, Beric, and Tormund. So those are 15 names, and that is the order that they're giving. So it's interesting to see that list. I think that they're missing a few people that I would want on that list. How is 1-1 not on this list? I mean, come on. 1-1 has got to be on the list. He's got to be at the top of the list. Also, you got 15 names, and you're not going to include Drogo. Robert Baratheon? Come on. In his prime, Robert Baratheon? I think that Aeron would like to see Ned on this list. I'd probably agree with him on that. I'll throw another few names out there. Rob, you don't want to see Rob on that opposing line. Not when he's got Grey Wind with him. Brown Ben Plum. So there are 15 names on that list, and we've added a few more. So we got about 20. We got a lot to work with. And then I wonder if I came up with my list of 15 genius strategists, I wonder if any names would overlap, if any names would make it onto both lists. So here is my list of the top 15 genius strategists as we have them through the end of Dance. And I think at the top of my list is going to be Bloodraven. The rest of these names are in no particular order. So Bloodraven's at the top. Tyrion, Lady Olenna, Varys, Illyrio, Littlefinger, Tywin, Margaery, Renly, Davos, Dany, Melisandre, the High Sparrow. And the last two will probably be controversial, but I'm going to put them on the list. Cersei and Catelyn. So this list does not include, for example, what I consider to be really top-notch field commanders. And those would be like Grey Worm, Robb, and Bronn. These are characters who I absolutely want to plan my battle, execute it. Do I want them planning the overall war? Probably not. Steven emailed in and suggested Robb and Jorah. Okay, Steven, I like the suggestion of Robb, and here's why. I like Robb because I put Tywin in pretty high on my list. I think Tywin's probably top five. And Robb almost won a war against him. So if Tywin's up there, maybe Robb should be up there too. But what was Robb's plan when he was going to, after he beat Tywin in a war? Did he know what he wanted? Was he thinking about this war and the next war too? Probably not. I don't know. Not enough information. Jorah is an interesting choice. As Steven points out, Jorah usually gives good advice to Dany. Here's how I view Jorah. Jorah gives good advice. He doesn't make mistakes. So I think he's a good counselor. Do I know enough about Jorah to think that he could be like a genius? I'm not sure about that. So anyway, those are good suggestions. They didn't make my list. Chad suggests Renly. Okay, Chad. Yes, in the books, Renly is a formidable presence. He looks like Robert Baratheon come again, and he's an amazing politician. So maybe he could be on both lists. I think that while he looks the part, do I have evidence of him as a battlefield badass? He can certainly command an army, do I get the sense that he was as formidable as Robert with a hammer or something like that? Still, not enough evidence. And then there are a couple names that probably will be on the list eventually, that being Arya. Walker of Dragons emailed. She suggests Arya, who is a will be a battlefield badass, probably already is, and probably also be a genius strategist by the end, but I don't think she's there yet. And then Sansa most certainly should be on the list of genius strategists eventually, but she's not there yet. So I think it's generally true, emphasis on the qualifier here, that in Martin's world, if you're a top flight strategist, you're probably not going to be a top flight battlefield badass and vice versa, because that would give one character too much advantage over the rest. But this is exactly why Euron worries me. I think that the glimpses that we have from Winds of Winter suggest that Euron might be a Bloodraven acolyte, and that will give him an enormous advantage, and he's also quite formidable on the battlefield as well. So I'm worried about Euron. I think he might make a very interesting adversary for our main characters. Okay, here's how we'll go forward. Next season, August-ish, I will have on both Linda Antonsen and Elio Garcia. These are two of the most knowledgeable people about Westeros in the world, Martin's co-authors. I think I might ask this question to either Elio or Linda. And I was thinking that if you had a question for Elio or Linda, you might send those to book at baldmove.com, and maybe your question for Linda or Elia will make it into one of those two interviews. Okay, so on August 5th, I will drop my recording with Chad about Eddard 7, that's chapter 30. So between now and then, go ahead and get caught up if you haven't. Some really fun summer reading if you've never read Game of Thrones before, or if you're doing the reread alongside of us. As always, thank you for listening. Please share this on social media or share it with a friend. And of course, we'd really appreciate a rank and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And that's all for this week.